This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Subscribe to the podcast Beyond Politics. They host some of the biggest names and smartest minds. Beyond Politics is from a former Democratic congressman who helped ignite Barack Obama's campaign and a former campaign manager and political columnist. They go beyond the usual chatter on politics, news, science, and books. It's politics and everything beyond. On Beyond Politics, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Broadcasting live on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, and in the evenings on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to have you with us today. Jam-packed today. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour from the Minnesota Reformer, Dina Winter is going to join us. And John Fugelsang, of course, sexy liberal himself. He is going to be in town here in Minneapolis, St. Paul for the Sexy Liberal Show. That is going to be coming up here on, I believe it's April 13th at the Pantages Theater. Then in Chicago at the Vic Theater, the DNC special, August 17th. He'll be out there as well. He's going to be kind enough to join us today to talk about various things and Sexy Liberal and going back on the road because he's very busy. Patrick, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You kind of sound like you're sitting on a fence line. I'm doing all right out here. I'm watching the cattle. Watch out for those cows, man. Watch out for those cows. In case you're in Chicago and you missed this little gem yesterday, we had a state senator here in Minnesota say the reason why we can't have safe gun storage laws in Minnesota is because of the threat of checks notes, cows. Yes, those cows.
It was a very moving argument.
Oh, dear Lord. Ow, ow, ow. Bad producer. Bad, bad. Actually, very nicely done. yeah, those cows. And apparently cows do kill like 20 people a year. I'm presuming where the cows are at. I mean, I'm here in my palatial broadcasting complex. Do we have a cow infestation in the house? Are those big traps we have in here in the building? Those cow sized ones?
That's a good question.
I thought that's how we got our producers.
Oh, is that how you get back at me now for the bad joke?
Yeah, just leave a hamburger there. We'll find someone in the morning. There we go. Now you're working for us. That's how it works. No, we do not have a cow infestation here at the radio station, nor do we torment our innocent civilians into becoming my producer. Cows. Yeah. Chicago. I want you to go outside in Chicago. How many cows are you seeing right now? Because that's, unless you're around cows, it's not a really good argument. Second of all, okay, so a cow actually is stamping on someone. You want to just start randomly firing rounds at them? You know you could hit the person who's being stampled. Stampeded. In Minnesota alone, by the way, in the last 2.5 months, because it's mid-March, we've had 5 kids get accidentally shot in the state of Minnesota. Yeah. There's an average of what, one, I think, cow stomping per year where there are cows. Yeah, it's not the smartest argument. It's not. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. One of the things which is we're touching on today is the Baltimore Bridge disaster, which there's a lot of information coming in. What it sounds like is that the boat had some serious problems, obviously, that was cutting power. If you've seen the video, the extended video, it's coming up river. It leaves the Baltimore port. It leaves the Baltimore port, takes a lazy turnaround, starts heading out to sea. It loses power, then the power comes back on, and then it loses power again. And by the time the power came back on again, it was too late. And it hit the bridge pretty flush there. 8 workers were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge when a container vessel struck it around 1:30 a.m. The bridge crashed into the river. In a shocking scene captured on video, six of the workers remained missing as of Tuesday afternoon. The crew was reportedly repairing potholes. Two people were rescued from the water. One was taken to the hospital. One has since been released. The second declined medical attention. The container vessel reported a power issue immediately before its collision, issued a Mayday call, which Maryland's governor said likely saved lives. As a matter of fact, it should not be put past. Apparently, they did manage to get the bridge somewhat blocked and was stopping traffic from getting on the bridge before the bridge went down. And that wasn't complete. There were some cars that you can actually see it. It's a little terrifying to watch the video. The incident is believed to be an accident not related to terrorism, state and federal officials say. The National Transportation Safety Board set to hold a press conference at about 1:30 this afternoon on the issue specifically. Joe Biden called Tuesday for the federal government to foot the bill for rebuilding the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore following the collapse earlier in the day. The ongoing search and rescue operation led by the U.S. Coast Guard is a top priority right now, Biden said in brief remarks from the White House on Tuesday afternoon. The bridge collapsed at 1:30 a.m. Biden said the federal government should fund all reconstruction costs. Congress will have to approve any federal funding. It's my intention that the federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing the bridge, and I expect the Congress to support my effort. Of course, you're always going to get some people. We're going to get the Republicans who are going to say, I'm never on that bridge. Why should my taxpayers pay for that? And of course, the same exact guy, when like a tornado or a hurricane hits their state, it's all of a sudden, we got hurt people here. We need help from the federal government. So there's going to be some. There's going to be some. Asked if the shipping company should be held responsible for the cost of reconstruction, Biden said the federal government should act before the determination of fault is made. That might be. We're not going to wait for that to happen. We're going to pay for it and get the bridge reopened and built. And I agree with that. Get the bridge reopened and built. And then if it's discovered, because obviously the first thing I have is, was the boat having mechanical and electrical issues prior to this accident? And if it had been reported having mechanical and electric issues, and the parent company of the ship had decided not to do any repairs on said ship, well, then they dang right we should drag them into court and basically make them pay for the entire cost of the bridge. I think that's just a given. Obviously a big concern. It's interesting because, of course, for the Chicago folks, we had quite a few years ago, the 35W bridge in downtown Minneapolis collapsed. That was due to an engineering failure. Basically, it wasn't designed correctly. And part of the problem was that people just didn't want to deal with, there was never really maintenance done on the bridge because conservative transportation policy in the state of Minnesota never really accounted for having to really do the heavy duty fixing of the bridge. It was always just fix some potholes and move on. And needless to say, that's part of the problem. When that happened, I was actually, it was interesting. At that point I was working for the Metro Traffic guys up here, and I was doing the airborne traffic, and there had been no traffic that day. That happened later in the day. There'd been no traffic. They said, okay, you can go down and land. And so I went out, I took my kids to the beach that afternoon and we went swimming. And as I get home, this was, kind of, I think pre-cell phone days for me. I think we still use the landline mainly. I get home and there's like five voicemail messages from people saying, Matt, tell me you're okay. Let us know you're okay. All these things. And one of them was my good friend, military friend Kirk, who lives out in the Baltimore area. And I called him right away. I'm fine. I wasn't there. I'm good. Well, as fate would have it, here we are, 20 some years later, and I'm doing the same exact thing. Not only I'm going back and, hey, are you okay? Where tell me, it was 1:30 in the morning. I feel pretty confident he wasn't on the bridge, but at the same time, right away had to, wanted to make sure my friend was okay.
I went through that too. A friend of mine in Baltimore, and I said, I know you're probably okay, but please just tell me your family's okay.
Yep, and exactly. And, It's one of those things. We don't realize how fragile this whole thing is. You don't realize how fragile it is until you see something like this and you realize how really fragile our world is. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Biden, by the way, said he would visit Baltimore as quickly as I can. The main story today in the news besides that, and I would actually make an argument the Baltimore Bridge collapse is the main story today, but obviously the story that we've been looking forward to and talking about in regards to the Supreme Court case in regards to mifepristone that came before the Supreme Court. And very quickly, I want to say, I don't think they're going to uphold this this ruling by this court, but not necessarily because all the evidence they brought forward were fraudulent, which I'm a little concerned about that. All the evidence they had, this group that this anti-abortion group had, has been proven to be faulty research, and it's been recanted at this point. And so there is no there there. We don't like this and we want it gone. That it doesn't seem to be the problem with that. I'll get to that here. A majority of the Supreme Court justices appeared skeptical Tuesday of the idea of a nationwide ban on new limits on mifepristone, the primary drug used for medical abortions. The case was the first abortion-related hearing since the court reversed Roe v. Wade, and the proceedings at the time went into detail about the process of any complications to use the medicational abortion. In issue with the courts or lower court rulings that would have rolled back the recent Food and Drug Administration decisions for easier access to mifepristone, conservatives and liberal justices demanded to know why access to mifepristone needed to be limited if the small number of doctors involved could simply exercise their own religious and conscientious objections individually. The decision is expected by July. If things seem to be going badly for the abortion pill challengers as the Tuesday hearing began to unfold in earnest, their prospects for prevailing appeared to grow even dimmer during the second hour of arguments. That's when Chief Justice John Roberts and Neil Gorsuch tore into the challenger's attorney over the nationwide impact caused by the lawsuit. So their problem seems to have been that you can't just have one district judge in Texas make policy issues for the entire country. And that is something which I'm not going to disagree with them because it's nice to see this, but this is the trick that the conservatives have set up. They have put these stooges, cannons down in Florida. You got this idiot in Texas, North Texas, who are there solely to push conservative agenda. And have no problem as a district court judge saying, I'm going to dictate policy for the entire country. Yeehaw! And that's what they do. And that's where they seem to kind of have some issues with this. Why can't the court specifically that this relief runs to precisely the parties before the court as opposed to looking at the agency in general and saying, agency, you can't do this anywhere, Robert said to the attorney. So basically he's saying, why is this more for everyone else versus just for in regards to these individual people. So, and that's an interesting argument, which they did not have an answer for. I'll come back to this in just a moment. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday. Somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Tuesday, 952-946-6205. So back to the mifepristone hearing over the SCOTUS. Now, Roberts basically brings up the point. It's like, okay, wait a second here. Why is this ruling for everybody? Wouldn't this just be better for you to have a case where this is for just you? Why should your concerns impact everyone in the country? This was to Erin Hawley, the attorney there. She began to explain her such a remedy would be impractical, which... okay, no, it'd be actually on point. That's when Gorsuch injected to speak in the recent spike of universal injunctions. Basically, a district court judge basically saying, I'm going to rule this and no one in the country can do this. He looked back and there is exactly zero universal injunctions that were issued during FDR's 12 years in office. Pretty consequential years in office. And over those last 4 years, the number of something like 60 and maybe more than that. and they're a relatively new thing, and you're asking us to extend and pursue these relatively new course, which the court has never adopted itself. So the court, he's basically saying the court, chooses to rule on the law. Now, I think this is a little bit of, nitpicking. But Gorsuch is saying, we don't go on out here looking to, basically write laws. We are reviewing cases. These district judges are clearly trying to write policy, and that should not be the case. This case seems like a prime example of turning what would be called a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other government action. The Biden administration contends that even if some action in favor of the plaintiffs was warranted, it should not have affected the entire country as opposed to just the litigants in the case. What the court did is enter sweeping nationwide relief that restricts access to mifepristone for every single woman in the country, and that causes profound harm, said Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger. The discussion at one point turned to a key question: if the doctors challenging the nationwide approval of mifepristone can simply raise a conscientious objection that doesn't require them to assist in an abortion rather than force a nation ban on the drug. So basically, you do have laws that say you don't have to do this if you don't want to. Why do you now have standing to take it away from every other doctor? So that's also an interesting point. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh asked whether federal law provides some protections for doctors who object to providing an abortion on moral or religious grounds, a sign that he may not be convinced that the plaintiff's doctors had the legal right, knowing his standing, to bring their suit against the FDA since they could not demonstrate any injury to themselves stemming from the agency's regulations because they could always opt out. Just to confirm on the standing issue, under federal law, no doctors can be forced against their conscience to perform or assist an abortion, correct, Kavanaugh, who is sometimes a swing vote in the court? Yes, Preloger said. We think the federal conscience protections provide broad coverage here. We think that those amendments guard against this kind of injury the respondents are asserting. Justice Alito, and by the way, let's just call it what it is. Alito and Thomas were basically arguing the plaintiff's case for them. They clearly are compromised. They came in with an agenda. They came in with talking points. I mean, somebody is pulling the strings of these two guys, and they came in arguing with the other justices that basically, no, you're misunderstanding. They of course have right. They have cause. This is a good thing. I mean, you might as well have put them both in cheerleader outfits, for God's sakes. He wrote the opinion reversing Roe v. Wade, Alito did. The fellow ardent abortion opponent, Justice Clarence Thomas, pushed the questions on whether anyone can actually challenge the FDA on drug approvals. The FDA wants to be infallible, Alito said at one point. Is there anybody who can sue and get judicial ruling on whether the FDA did was lawful? And maybe what they did was perfectly lawful, but shouldn't somebody be able to challenge that in court, he said. Preloger stressed that challengers to FDA drug approvals need to show concrete harm to themselves, not simply a wider objection to policy. Justice Jackson, though, flipped the question from Alito on its head to give the FDA's defenders an opportunity to argue the agency is better suited to make calls on medical science than the courts are, which was a pretty spectacular moment. I mean, that was Alito basically saying, shouldn't they be able to challenge them in courts? And Jackson said, well, shouldn't medical professionals make these decisions as opposed to a judge? And yeah, no, it's clear Thomas and Alito are bought and paid for. Let's just call it what it is. Bought and paid for. They were fed talking points. They were fed their questions. They were fed all their arguments because they've got a 5-star resort they want to go to, and Clarence has got an eye on a brand new RV. And his wife is a traitorous hag, if I can mention that. Ginny Thomas is a traitor to the country. She is. Anyway. Congress gave the FDA authority to regulate drugs more than 60 years ago. In 1962, it was also given the authority to require the drug companies prove the drugs are effective. Mifepristone was initially approved in 2000. Regulators around it have shifted since then. Alito said that a long unenforced federal law banning mailing of drugs used for abortion was not obscure, but rather prominent law. This is the Comstock Act, which is basically, it's a 19th century statute outlawing the use of mail to send various lewd materials, is the direct quote. Some anti-abortion activists see the law as an avenue to end medical abortion and perhaps all kinds of abortions. The Comstock Act has not been a central part of this case, but the challengers have gotten a little bit of traction in the lower court level with the argument the FDA acted unlawfully in its approach to mifepristone because it did not take an action. The Comstock Act's criminal prohibitions on mailing drugs used for abortions. Prelogar countered the Tuesday that this is not the FDA's job to enforce criminal law, but that the agency did get advice on the time from the Justice Department about its interpretation of law. I think that Comstock provisions don't fall within the FDA's lane, she said. So basically, that if you want to do this, and this is what they're saying, is that the FDA has to enforce the Comstock Act, which is not their responsibility. This is a legislative issue, and that and maybe even a law enforcement issue, but I think it's more of a legislative issue that they have to define specifically what this is, because once again, there's a lot of vagueness in the Comstock Act, but they want to basically act as if that this is something that's concrete. And by the way, I think at one point one of the Supreme Court justices mentioned, or one of the lawyers mentioned, that the Comstock Act hasn't been enforced in like 80 some years. And so for them all of a sudden to go this way is, you know, kind of a joke. So let's evaluate before I get into the break. And then John Fugelsang coming in here. Definitely you've got what seems to be at least five, if not six. I mean, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Roberts, the three liberal judges, they seem to be on board that this is, you can't have a district judge basically making federal policy on an issue on one ruling. You can't do that. Also, it's kind of one of those things where they don't have standing. They haven't proved they've been hurt. And so that gets knocked down. Where Barrett's at, she seemed to side with the skeptics. But my guess is going to be this is going to be a 7-2 or a 6-3 ruling. My guess is 7-2, because I'm going to also throw this little gem out there. Trust me, those conservative justices know that if they rule against this, that is the election. And they'll get wiped. The Republicans will get wiped out in November. They know that. We'll take a break. John Fugelsang, when we return, it's the Matt McNeil Show.
Oh, I've seen Trump.
Broadcasting in the evening on WCPT 820 Chicago's Progressive Talk, and in the afternoons on the Mothership AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. My absolute privilege and pleasure to welcome to the show John Fugelsang. Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberals Save the World Comedy Tour is going to be coming to the Pantages Theater in Minneapolis. That's going to be on April 13th. Then Chicago, look for them at the Vic Theater, the DNC special, on August 17th. And John is kind enough to join us from the West Coast today. Hi, John.
Oh, Matt, it's so great to be back on your show. Hello, everybody. I'm really thrilled to be coming back. It's going to be hotter than Tim Scott and Mindy's wedding night. I promise you that.
It's got to be a little bit fun to a point to get back on the road. You were touring on your own. You did Sexy Liberal. Obviously, pandemic smacked that down. You guys have done a few shows. But this is a very ambitious tour that starts not only in Minneapolis, but then you actually are going to be touring all the way until next year in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, we're really doing it, Matt. We've teamed up with Live Nation after like a dozen years doing this tour. We finally decided, no, let's do it, and let's get in bed with those fine people. Yes. So we're playing all over. And yeah, you're right. We're going to be playing in Chicago for the Democratic Convention. We'll be starting the whole tour off in Minneapolis on the 13th, and we're going to wrap the whole thing up in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Weekend 2025, regardless of who wins. So it's a fun tour if you've never seen it. It's great to come and be in a room with 2,000 other people who are just as amoral, but moral, as you. And, so many people in this country, like, were terrified to have an Obama sticker on their car when they went to their job or their church. And so this is really a great atmosphere to realize, oh, my God, I'm in a room with a whole bunch of people and no one's wearing a red hat. And no one's going to blame DEI if the power goes out, if you know what I'm saying. You're racist-free, folks. Racist-free.
You, Steph, I should mention Hal Sparks, Frangela, all going to be there as well, and special guests. And once again, that's coming to both Minneapolis, Chicago. Go look at Sexy Liberal on Live Nation. You can find the tickets. Get tickets. You'll want to go see this. It's absolutely, in this insanity of an election season, it is going to be nice to have you here. For God's sakes, and I'm going to bring this up just real quick, one religious thing. Trump is putting out a $60 Bible now. Did you see this?
I saw this, of course. Of course he should. And why shouldn't he? Why shouldn't he? I mean, like, there's something he's not supposed to grift off of. Like, if Donald Trump was tasteful about the Bible, I'd be worried, Matt. But this is cool. I thought it was great that he autographed Bibles because both Trump and Jesus used ghostwriters, but this is the Lee Greenwood Donald Trump Bible with his crappy God Bless the USA, which I respect because Lee Greenwood's a lot like the Bible. Trump voters don't know anything about either one of them besides the greatest hits. So in that sense, fantastic. Most Trump supporters only know about Jesus, the manger and the cross. They skip over everything he ever talked about because if you knew Jesus's teachings, you couldn't support Trump. So what a shock that they also are fans of another one-hit wonder. It seems to be how their brains operate.
He needs some help with marketing because, I mean, you got gold sneakers and now a Bible. You're all over the place like an airport store at this point. You need to kind of focus it down a little bit more, I think.
No, I think it's perfect. I mean, look, we'll eventually get to the golden calf, but this is Donald Trump, Matt. You know this. The American Christians have finally replaced everything Jesus ever talked about with criminalizing abortion, which Jesus never talked about. And that's why they've thrown out everything Jesus said to embrace this unholy hybrid of Caligula, Barabbas, Judas, and the golden calf, yes, all in one disgusting package.
And I don't know if you saw the number, but in January when we were talking about Iowa back then and their primary, they talked to Republicans and, you know, evangelical Trump supporters in Iowa, and they all said the same thing. Oh, I only go to church once a year, if that. And I'm like, okay, how in the world is this even a possibility? In my lifetime, I remember, you know, you were a religious, you know, politician. You were going to church every week. It was kind of one of those things. Now it's like, maybe I'll think about it, but I'm very Christian. There seems to just be this, it's this devoid of any kind of rationality to it.
No, but it's not. It's completely rational. You know, I think what's irrational is saying you have to go to church every Sunday or you can't be a real Christian. I mean, let's be honest. Like, you know, showing up in church doesn't make you a good Christian any more than showing up in your garage makes you a good car. It's about what you do. And for me, being Christian, and I was raised abnormally Christian by an ex-nun and an ex-Franciscan. So, you know, my parents were both married to the guy beforehand, and he got heavy visitation rights in our house. To me, Matt, it's about following Jesus's teachings, not about believing in the magic tricks, although nothing against the miracles.
Hey.
Listen, all the great Jew magicians, started Houdini, David Blaine, David Copperfield, Teller, it all began with Jesus. He was the first great Jew magician. We don't give him credit for this. Likewise, the Jews make all the good Christmas albums. Neil Diamond and Barbra Streisand and Bob Dylan. I'm here to be supportive here. But in terms of Jesus as a person, he was a peaceful, radical, nonviolent revolutionary. He never mentioned abortion, never put down gay people. He was against the death penalty. He was anti-public prayer, Matthew 6:5. And he was a long-haired, brown-skinned, homeless, unarmed, community organizing, anti-slut-shaming, Palestinian, brown-skinned, liberal Jew. That's the guy they pretend to follow. And as you well know, Mr. McNeil, the only way you can follow both Jesus and Donald Trump is if you've never read either of their books. That's it. There's no Jesus-based justification for Trump support. I'll say it again. There is no Jesus Christ-based support for supporting Trump. And you can do this with your right-wing loved ones. Even if you're an atheist, and some of the best Christians I know are atheists, Mr. McNeil, but all you've got to do is just say, tell me one actual teaching of Jesus that Donald Trump or the Republican Party or MAGA fights for. Chapter and verse, just one. And this is how you'll find out how little your right-wing loved ones or coworkers have actually read this book they wave around like a prop.
I always love throwing the Gospel of Matthew at them. I really do. It's like
that's it. Matthew 25, Jesus gives his marching orders.
Exactly.
Said, you're going to individuals and nations. Mm-hmm. Very important. Because you know the right-wing Christian. Oh, I do this in my personal life, but Jesus never said the government should hold a gun to my head and make me favor the Benghazi. Yeah, you know, they always give the rationale to vote against Jesus on election day. But Jesus gives it all out in Matthew 25, the parable of the goats and the sheep. He says he will command individuals and nations to care for the poor, care for the sick, be kind to those in prison, and welcome the stranger. On immigration policy alone, they're not Christian. The only law in the entire Bible, Old Testament or New, is the commandment to welcome the stranger. I have no problem with a government based on Christian values. I really don't. I've never seen them from our loudest Christians, Matt.
Yeah. I want to talk with you a little bit as well about the election, because when I had Steph on a few days ago,
Are you okay with that? Yeah. Did you recover from that? Thoughts and prayers.
I love Steph, man. I love Steph. She would join me.
Was she at all abusive to you verbally? Is there anything you want to talk to HR about, Matt?
No, she was in a bed. She did the interview from a bed with her dogs.
Oh, so you really want to talk to HR? Okay.
No, I'm cool with that, man. I'm cool with that. All right. Okay. We look at these numbers that are coming out of these states, specifically like Arizona, Georgia, and Trump is still losing 20-25% of the vote in these states of his own party. I mean, clearly the guy that's going to be the candidate, he still can't seal the deal. The numbers reports in regards to the finances, he is so far behind Biden right now, and a lot of his own money he's diverting to his legal causes. He's creating a real big problem here, and I mean, obviously, we have to do this election. Everyone votes. No one sits this out. But I'm seeing a lot of problems. As much as the media likes to say there's big cracks in the Democratic Party, the reality is where all the cracks are right now, literally, is in the Republican Party at this point.
I agree. Look how much the Democrats have healed from the great Bernie-Hillary Civil War of '16. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, say what you want, she had such discipline in getting that entire caucus on the same page. My whole life has been Democrats at war with each other. This whole, like, screw you for only agreeing with me on 85% of policies. That's been the Democratic Party my whole life. Not anymore. They are so unified. That's continued under this president. And the Republican Party, I mean, they might wind up trying to fire their second speaker inside of a year. And you're right. I mean, right now, the big money donors are hiding from Donald Trump like 14-year-old girls backstage at a beauty pageant hide from Donald Trump. In 2023, he spent $50 million in Republican donor funds on his own legal fees, which I think is brilliant, Matt. I support this. Funnel all the RNC cash to one candidate. No money for down ballot racists. Turn the RNC into his GoFundMe by putting your daughter-in-law, who has no experience, in charge of it. Matt, Lara Trump is going to defile the RNC bank account like it's a Tom Petty song. It's going to be beautiful. And if the RNC is paying his legal bills, how is this not a gift and therefore taxable as income? These are the things I think about when I'm sitting home alone all day, Mr. McNeil. Uh-huh. But he's bleeding them all dry, because when you donate to Trump, you're donating to E. Jean Carroll going shopping. That's what you're doing.
Well, and he can't, you know, financially, and I mean, obviously, you get into the realm of the finances he has, trying to get, you know, $464 million for a bond. You don't have the cash around, you have the business. But he clearly has these properties leveraged to the hilt, and no one is, I mean, even the conservative groups are like, okay, no, we're not even touching this. There's no there, and it's clear this guy's just a massive orange leech is just going to suck every damn dollar out of the Republican Party.
Exactly right. That's why he's bringing Paul Manafort back in.
Yes.
And by the way, anytime anyone says there was no collusion, you just have a two-word response, Paul freaking Manafort, to that. Donald Trump's second campaign manager fired for, let me check, colluding with Russia during the campaign. I feel bad for Trump, because I hate it when I've got to pay $400 million for a bond for a guilty verdict because I lied and inflated my net worth, but now no one's going to lend me the money because they know my net worth is not as much as I lied it was for all those years. And can I say one other thing? If I was Donald Trump and my son-in-law Jared had got $2 billion from a Saudi prince because we helped him together cover up a murder, and Jared still wouldn't help me out, I'll be honest, Matt, I would start being attracted to my other daughter. I really would. I really would start lusting after my other daughter. Just because it's just for the morals of it.
By the way, you bring up the Jared Kushner thing. He does have a ton of money from Saudi Arabia, and at no point has he returned, father-in-law's calls. And I mean, and one person said, okay, if he did give him the money, he'd have to tax it. So literally, that's your entire thing. Well, I'm going to get taxed on the money. I'm sorry, Dad, you're on your own. That is such a broken family. It's delicious.
I know. I mean, what could be better than uneducated Republicans donating to a crook, getting no returns on their investments, and losing the election? One of the reasons so many of these congressmen are dropping out, I believe, is because the state RNCs are being bled dry.
Yes.
The money, I mean, when you donate, your money is going to Save America PAC. They're not donating in any way to the RNC. And when they do, they're fleecing it. I mean, right now with this, he's directing 10% of every dollar he gets online to his PAC. Used to be 1%. Now it's 10%. And they're heavily in debt, just like Trump himself. I'm sure if you added up all of his properties, Matt, he'd probably have $1 billion. But if you added up all of his debts and liens, I mean, it's insane. This guy doesn't have the money. And I keep reminding everyone every night on Sirius XM, don't forget to stop and smell the train wreck. Because most likely he's going to lose, and going to lose horribly. And I mean, as we saw this week, he's still helping nominate Senate candidates who are arguably unelectable, but they're loyal to him. Mm-hmm. What we saw in Ohio, Donald Trump insisting that they get this guy Bernie Moreno may have just helped the Democrats keep the Senate, because I think Sherrod Brown's seat looks a lot safer after putting this lunatic in charge. But the media, you know this, the media is still like, oh, for months it was all Biden's old, and then they got over that. And I'm so tired of the ageism, Mr. McNeil, you don't even know. But now the media's whole thing is, oh, Americans don't want this election. They're both so unpopular. You get this, mad. Americans are mad at this choice. We want better Canada. I mean, you got Donald Trump led a violent terrorist attack against the Capitol and ended 200 years of peaceful transfer of power. And over on this side, you got Joe Biden, who thinks women should have control of their own bodies. I mean, who am I supposed to vote? Both sides have lost their minds, Matt.
John, what time is your show on Sirius XM?
We're on 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, 5 nights a week, whether you like it or not.
All right, I'll make sure I link to that. And then a reminder, you can see John in town in Minneapolis April 13th at the Pantages Theater, and in Chicago, get your tickets at the Vic Theater August 17th. John Fugelsang, sexy liberal. John, as always, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You, Mr. McNeil, you're the best.
Take a break, come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Fugelsang, man. Freak. If you've not seen John Fugelsang, the Sexy Liberal Tour, let me just be honest with you. Steph is phenomenal. Phenomenal. Hal Sparks is hilarious. Frangela there. You got Fugelsang. If you've not seen John Fugelsang come out and work the audience, holy God, he is brilliant. You get the chance to see him anytime. Go see him. He's really good. He's coming into town both for Minneapolis and Chicago, so go catch that. All right? You'll have a good time there. I got to bring this story up because this just, do you want to understand what conservative America gets you, what these conservative policies get you? The Utah women's basketball team had to switch hotels after experiencing what head coach Lynn Roberts called racial hate crimes ahead of its first NCAA tournament game. According to Roberts, the team was staying at a hotel at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, before a first-round game against South Dakota State in Spokane, Washington, late last week when the incidents occurred. Now, apparently, Coeur d'Alene is near Spokane. It's like a 30-minute drive. And even the Utah coaches were like, we're not quite sure where we were there. But it sounds like what the Gonzaga people, because they were the host team, was Gonzaga. Gonzaga said that in Spokane, most of the, because the men's team was also playing, that there was already a pretty much booked out hotel. So that's why they had to put them in Coeur d'Alene. The several incidents of some kind of racial hate crimes towards a program. It was incredibly upsetting for all of us. Roberts told the reporters on Monday, there's so much diversity on college campuses, so you're just not exposed to that very often. Racism is real. It happens. It's awful. So for our players, like the whether they're white, black, green, whatever, no one knows how to handle it. It was really upsetting. Utah, by the way, did defeat South Dakota State on Saturday before losing 77-66 to Gonzaga in the tournament's second round on Monday. CNN contacted Utah and Gonzaga for further comment. Following the alleged racist incidents, Roberts said that the Utes switched hotels after just one night before their games in Spokane. For our players, and because one of the teams lost and their fans went home, that opened up some hotel rooms in Spokane, and it sounds like Gonzaga as well very quickly came out there and said, you know, let's get you over to Spokane. For our players and staff to not feel safe in an NCAA tournament environment, it's messed up, and we moved hotels. The NCAA and host university Gonzaga worked to get us a new hotel, and we appreciate that. That's what happened. It was a distraction and upsetting and unfortunate. This should be positive for everybody involved. This should be a joyous time for our program. We have a kind of black eye on this experience. It's unfortunate. Spokane was also a predetermined site for the first two rounds for the men's tournament with Utah, UC Irvine, and South Dakota State women's teams all staying in the area. The hotel space was limited. After the elimination of some of the men's teams, they were able to move the team there. The source added that because Utah and UCI had been based in Idaho, Gonzaga had arranged for police escorts to ensure the drive time to the venue did not exceed approximately 30 minutes, which is a condition of being able to host after earning a top 16 seed. After those two teams were moved into Spokane hotels, police escorts continued to be provided for them, according to a source. The details of the alleged racist incident are unclear. Apparently, though, the athletic director for Utah has told us what happened. So apparently the team, the Utah women's basketball team, gets to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. They're going out to dinner. While they go out to dinner, some raging racist jackass is in a pickup truck revving their car incredibly aggressively, screaming the N-word at them in the parking lot of the restaurant. When they left the restaurant, apparently there were two more people who were in pickup trucks who were revving the cars like they were going to drive at these people and screaming at them and the N-word repeatedly to them. So it wasn't, oh, well, they thought that was racist. No, they were screaming the N-word apparently the entire time while revving their car engines in a threatening tone. The NCAA declined to comment when contacted by the CNN on this story. I want to, first of all, the Coeur d'Alene mayor has come on out and said, this is not us. Shut up, man. That is all of freaking Idaho. Have you seen the stories coming out of your damn state lately? For God's sakes, half the state believes in some, anti-American zealot who's a folk hero in your state. No, you're a bunch of racist backward jackasses. And that's just that. It's Idaho. And it's a problem here. And let me make sure with the NCAA. I'll give them a little bit of an out on Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And by the way, you want to shut me up? Then fine. Stop being such racist jackasses, Idaho. Stop it. Or find these three clowns and drag them by their hillbilly freaking beards we already know they have out of their damn pickup trucks and put them into court and charge them with a hate crime. As you should. Jesus. I get to a point the NCAA said we're giving it to Spokane, Washington, and so didn't anticipate a racist world over in Idaho. But I do want to make sure I point out the NCAA still allows Oklahoma, which has some incredibly racist and bigoted laws on their books about the LGBTQ and the transgender community in their books, to host the softball tournament. So their outrage over, way people get mistreated is really, 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 arbitrary. It really is. It is an insane disappointment that this is there. But this is, Idaho is the poster child for what you get in America when you have just this concentrated, conservative-only mentality. That if your starting point of news and information is Fox, you know that basically you're getting out to, you know, loner compound militia group news, and they're having a reach. It's a shame. The NCAA, and I'm frankly, I think they should pull out, they should tell the Idaho universities, we're not going to bring our football teams there. You got to play in neutral sites outside of your state until you clean up your damn mess. Whether or not they'll do something I don't know, but I don't have a lot of faith in the NCAA because you know why the truth is they're okay with bigotry and racism is, you know, to a point. And so for them to basically come out and say, oh, we're outraged about what happened in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I'm not buying it. I think that they're just going to hang their heads. Chicago, talk to you tomorrow. Minneapolis, St. Paul, hour two up next. Hour two of the show here on your Tuesday. Matt and Brett and Patrick, huzzah. God, can I just tell you one thing I can't stand about winter storms? I can't stand when they tell me, oh, it's going to be done snowing at 2. Then they come back like, oh, it's going to be done snowing at 4. Oh, it's going to be done snowing at 6. Oh, it's going to be done snowing at 2 a.m. You know, I can't stand when they draw this out. It was supposed to be done snowing at 2. It's now they're saying 6:30 it's going to be done. And it went from like 2 inches to now we're going to get like 4 inches. And it's not that, I understand predicting weather is difficult, but it was this morning you were saying this. Mm-hmm. How are you this far off on a single day?
Yeah, that's a little different than the 3 days out. Oh, yeah, we were wrong a little bit. No, you think that's a little easier with the modern computer models to be able to figure that stuff out. But
you would think so.
I guess not. I guess that means, you got to kind of use your own intuition as the meteorologist on when it's going
to
end.
Someone has mentioned to us that the TuneIn app, okay, and just for everyone out there, TuneIn carries AM 950's radio programming out there. You're not listening to us on TuneIn right now. We know. We had to update some computer programming, stuff like this. A lot of when TuneIn gets it back up depends on how much you guys go over there and tell TuneIn, get them back up. So, you know, they'll eventually get to us. But imagine if you guys go tell TuneIn app, hey, get AM 950 back up and running again as quickly as possible. That will help things out. I don't want to be nice about it, be nice and congenial, but... until that time, we do have plenty of places that people can still listen to us online.
Yeah, if you're someone that listens on the website, you really won't be able to tell the difference. The link is still working on there. And once we get this all straightened out for TuneIn, I think you'll really appreciate it as a listener. I know some people have had trouble on Chrome occasionally listening, and that should be completely solved once we get this all straightened out with TuneIn. So improved experience on the way, but we just got to get them going so they can get our new link posted so you can listen on that TuneIn app.
And for some of those freaks out there, they can always listen to the show by watching it.
Camera's right there.
There it is. I got into radio when it was one media outlet. There it is. They're going to finally put the neural link on my head. Also, one other thing we have to mention sometime this hour. Yeah, you heard John Fugel saying on the show a little earlier, fantastic person. The Sexy Liberals coming to Minneapolis, St. Paul, Pantages Theater, April 13th. We have a pair of tickets to give away at some point this hour. So you need to listen for your chance on when to call in. Not right now. We'll tell you when to call in later on today. So I got two for us from our friend, Mike Lindell.
Yeah, he's had a busy news day, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. First of all, a landlord for one of the MyPillow company's manufacturing facilities has asked a judge to evict MyPillow, the pillow giant, from the premises, saying the company has failed to pay more than $200,000 in rent over the past 2 months. MyPillow, headquartered in Chaska, that's a bad sign, man, has received at least 4 default notices since September from the Shakopee warehouse, according to the court filings. The latest eviction notice says the company is behind the payments for February and March, owing Delaware-based First Industrial LP more than $217,000 for rent and other charges for the facility located on Valley Boulevard South. MyPillow has more or less vacated, but we'd like to do this by the book, said attorney Sarah Filo, representing First Industrial, and at a hearing in an eviction court on Tuesday. Eviction court. Wow, that's not good, man. At this point, there's a representation that no further payment is going to be made under this lease. We'd like to go ahead with finding a new tenant. Scott County Chief Judge Carolyn Lennon said the court would issue the order as soon as it's submitted. So basically, MyPillow is done. is still, this facility, I should say, is still currently leasing a second manufacturing warehouse outlet located in Shakopee. I was just on Sunday. I went over because it was snowing out. I went to a mall and hiked around. And you remember, it was only, what, 6-7 years ago that every mall had a MyPillow store in it. We have the cutout of Mike Lindell from one of those stores here.
Yeah, Mike still visits every now and then.
Yeah, every once in a while, when I feel, you know, scared and need some cuddling, I grab Mike Lindell. I clutch him like he clutches a pillow. He's lost all his stores. As a matter of fact, we were going through, it's like, yeah, he doesn't, there's nothing as far as a retail footprint anymore, at least not to my knowledge. I mean, maybe at his warehouse, maybe he's got a warehouse store down there. He was all over the news media. He's not there. He's now lost one of his two warehouses, which he apparently has already vacated. I don't think his company is going to survive much longer, man. I just don't think it.
Which is too bad, considering all the employees he has working for him. That's the serious part, is a lot of people, if that goes down, could be looking for new work, and that's not a good thing.
For 3 years, dude, you and I have been three years saying to him, just apologize profusely, get out of your own way. Nope. Speaking of which, I got the second story from Mike. MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell has been trying to get out of paying $5 million he owes a Nevada-based software developer and computer forensics expert Robert Zeidman, who won Lindell's Prove Me Wrong Challenge in 2021, a victory that U.S. District Judge John Thunheim upheld as perfectly legitimate in a February 21st ruling. But according to Law and Crime's Brandy Buckman, he'll be waging his legal battle now without two lawyers who have abandoned him. Abandoned him. It's like a Dickens tale in London in the 1850s. You've been abandoned. I want more.
It's not good if the lawyer abandons you.
Did you open the door of the car and tell him, hey, Mike, go fetch that ball out there? Sitting by the side of the road with the ball in his mouth. I'm not saying he did. I'm just saying that's what it sounds like when they say abandon. Andrew Parker and Alec Beck, both of the Minneapolis-based firm Parker Daniels Kibort, and I'm K-I-B-O-R-T, Kibort, at his cyber symposium event in South Dakota in 2021, still good seats available, by the way, Lindell offered to pay $5 million to anyone who could disprove his claim that Chinese government officials helped now President Biden steal the election. And reminder, what he had was he had just this file of numbers. And so this guy starts looking at him and he said, no, it's just a random bunch of numbers. And he's proved it over and over and over again in court. And so he owes him $5 million. Zeidman took the challenge and claims that because he thoroughly disproved Lindell's conspiracy theory, he owes him the prize. Lindell insists that he doesn't owe the money because Zeidman didn't disprove his election claims. But Thunheim agreed with Zeidman. Nonetheless, Lindell continues to fight, Buckman explains, as two of his attorneys withdraw from the case. Lindell has been greenlit to appeal to a federal judge's ruling last month, affirming he must pay $5 million to a software engineer. But now he doesn't have lawyers who defeated him. Maybe I have to get Jack Rice on the line for this one. Can you go into an appeals court after a ruling and say, I'm here to defend myself, I don't want to pay? I mean, it's because, let's face it, I mean, the jokes aside about the Sasquatch and stuff like this, if he's got this evidence, you bring it into the courtroom. Here it is. Here's the evidence. Mm-hmm. He has not done that. He's not going to do it because the evidence doesn't exist. At least it doesn't appear to exist. He's had more than enough opportunities to present it either publicly or in court, and he still has yet to do so. He's trying to win a game he's already lost and lost badly.
And trying to keep playing the game, thinking he's eventually going to win. When you fall further and further behind, it's a vicious cycle, and yeah, it's not good. If you can't pay his lawyers and then you have this appeals case, I don't know what you do in that situation. I don't think you could bring in like a public defender of all things.
Well, no, you wouldn't. It would be a criminal. It would be a.
Oh, yeah, this isn't criminal. Yeah, this is a civil trial. Yeah, I don't know what you would do in a civil case. You're right.
Yeah, this is a civil case. So I don't quite, I guess technically he could go in there, but You know, or, you know, if I've, you
all
know,
things maybe, always go well when you represent yourself in court.
Just talking to the January 6th guys. They're all stunned. Stunned, you say, that I'm going to jail for 8 years? Okay. No, I mean, I'm done saying, you know, you can't do it. You're losing your business. It's shedding layers like a freaking onion at this point. You're losing lawyers. So you're basically at the point of, I've watched a few Law and Order episodes. I think I'm ready to go here. I just don't know where you're going to go. I just don't have any idea.
Yeah. I don't know where he goes from here either. I mean, eventually you're going to run out of money. He's already run out of that. You're going to run out of credit or whatever else you need to try getting people to help you out with this, whether it's lawyers, employees.
And you and I have said the same thing, man. It's a lot of employees. You got a lot of employees whose life, you know, have stood by you and been there, and they just want to make pillows and whatever else you're making down there. And, you know, their jobs are online, because we still haven't gotten to the two lawsuits where the defamation suits, that's going to be bad. That's going to mean Fox News. How much did Fox News pay? $700 million?
Oh, right. Yeah,
So Fox News paid $700 million to them because there was no evidence of them doing any wrongdoing. I just don't know how the rest of your life is going to be miserable. They're going to be basically like, you're going to get basic expenses and that's it, because you owe the rest of these guys, these election companies, all this money. And I feel sorry for him, but that's going to be the end of it. Now, whether or not one of the election voting machine companies takes over My Pillow and starts making pillows, I don't know. I don't think they would.
Smartmatic.
Smartmatic pillows. Dominion pillows.
Dominion.
Sleep on your vote.
You got a good marketing strategy.
Hey, it's like not my first day. All right. Well, there's your Mike Lindell update. Speaking of which... let's turn to the Minnesota Reformer. We usually get joined by Cooligan, but not today. We actually get the best damn journalist in this town right now today. That's Dina Winter.
Yeah, and we're going to continue speaking about Mike Lindell, since, as you may be aware, she has written about him many times, including a few months ago when she basically got to be a fly on the wall for a couple of days at the MyPillow headquarters. So I was interested in getting her perspective on what's been happening with these eviction notices for Mike Lindell and where he goes from here. So we're going to be talking with her about Mike Lindell, and then we'll also touch on the the Minnesota legislature and how Republicans are trying to create a new wedge issue. So that's what's coming up next.
All righty. It's Dina Winter with Brett right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And today we are joined by someone from the Minnesota Reformer, not Patrick Houlihan. We have someone filling in from today, and that is the great Dina Winter, who, of course, we have spoken to a couple of times on the show, as we have a lot of news to talk about today, including MyPillow being evicted from their building in Chaska. We'll also be talking about some news and the legislature, so lots to get to today here with Dina Winter of the Minnesota Reformer. Dina, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I got to start off talking about, well, someone you're very familiar with and have reported on him many times throughout the past, and that is the CEO of MyPillow, Mike Lindell, who, of course, is also someone who has peddled many election-related conspiracy theories going back to 2020. But here's what's happening with Mike Lindell. The landlord of the building that houses MyPillow in Chaska is evicting the company after MyPillow fell behind by about $200,000 or 2 months of rent right now. So why exactly, Dina, did this Delaware-based company called First Industrial decide to evict Lindell? Was there basically no hope of repayment? Were they kind of looking at this as a last resort? What reasonings were they giving for why they decided to finally pull the trigger and evict MyPillow from this building?
Well, according to the Star Tribune story, they're saying that they had given them at least four default notices since September for this warehouse in Shakopee, and was behind by over $200,000 in rent. Although I might add that it appears that this is not the warehouse. When I spent time with him a few months ago, he has a Shakopee warehouse, but it appears he has two of them. Mm-hmm. And the big one where they're doing, you know, producing all these products and they have a little outlet store, that's where I was with him. That does not appear to be the one that is getting evicted. So I'm not I mean, just to be clear, I don't think it's like they're shutting them down anytime soon, because I didn't even know he was still using this other warehouse in Shakopee, but that appears to be the one that's getting evicted.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go, because as I saw in the article, yeah, he does have that second facility down in Shakopee, and as you stated, that's where you spent the bulk of your, or at least all of your time, I believe, with him when you had a chance to spend a day with Mike Lindell. Do we know anything about the financial status of the building that they're renting in Shakopee? Are they falling behind on payments there, too, or is that something we just don't quite know right now, or maybe we won't find out until they are actually behind on their payments? Similar to what's
happening.
Yeah,
I haven't heard anything about the other one, and I'm assuming if there was anything going on with that one, they would have reported it also. The first day I was with him, we spent at the headquarters, which is in building, former bank building by Chaska, in Chaska, I think it's within the city limits. And then they have their warehouse where they're actually making all these products in Shakopee. So someone asked me, oh my God, are they going to go to business tomorrow? And it's like, I mean, I texted Mike, he hasn't replied, which is very unusual for him. Mm-hmm. But I asked him, about it. But I don't think it's like they're going out of business anytime soon. So, I mean, like if they were behind on that building, that would seem to be a major problem.
Yeah, as you stated, that's where they have the bulk of their operations, is out of that Shakopee facility. It sounds like they really weren't doing too much out of this Chaska facility anymore. So you'd even wonder, maybe they weren't going to renew their lease anyways and decided to just take the eviction anyways, which I know doesn't necessarily help your company's credit. But if they weren't doing much in Chaska, I suppose this probably wasn't too much of a surprise.
Well, the Chaska, that's the headquarters.
I gotcha.
That's like where all his offices are. And that's not the one they're talking about either. They're talking about, so there are two warehouses in Shakopee. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what was going on in this one where he's getting evicted, because we were in the other one, which is just a huge warehouse where they're making pillows and then all kinds of other products now too. And that is not the one that's getting evicted.
Gotcha. Glad you clarified that, yeah, because that is important to point out. Yeah, they're not getting evicted from their headquarters. It's this second facility down in Shakopee. But at least given your interactions with Mike Lindell over the past few months and years, and the fact that you had a chance to spend a lot of time with him and seeing how he kind of runs his operation on a day-to-day basis, at least from what I read in your article a few months ago, he has a very haphazard style way, I guess, of deciding to pay bills. So overall, this probably isn't too surprising, just given all the financial stress that he's under and the fact that, as I was kind of mentioning, has his very own sort of odd way of deciding how to pay bills, where it basically just says, pay that, don't pay that, pay that, don't pay that.
Yeah, I remember when I was out there, I was just kind of trying to be a fly on the wall. And pretty early on in the day, he was on a phone call with it seemed to be a guy that helps pay the bills or something. And he would be like, well, what about this? And when is that due? And, okay, pay that one. And kind of put this one off. So it was really clear that he was, really deciding which bills to pay is the way it definitely came across, and was under some financial pressure for sure. But then you'd talk to him on one minute, you'd be saying he's broke, all he's got left is his pickup, and then the next minute, like, he's making a phone call, scheduling flights to Texas, dropping his wife off in Texas, moving, going on to Florida, and it's clear he's still using a private jet. So it's like, and I asked him about it. He said, "Well, it's a leased jet. It's always been leased." But I mean, still, So I was never quite sure how broke, what his financial situation is. But I think it's becoming pretty clear, and that's why I wanted to do the story. Really, was to see what's going on with him as things are really beginning to start. I really think the future of the company was at stake when I went out there, and I wanted to see what was going on and how he was dealing with it.
Yeah, and that guy and a lot of other people, no matter what you think about his politics, don't want to see a company like MyPillow end up going under, because that would certainly be a lot of people who would potentially get unemployed in that situation. So I don't think anyone wants to see that. And We'll have to see what happens with MyPillow and their future. We are recording this at about 2:30 in the afternoon here on Tuesday, and as you said, Mike Lindell has not texted you yet, but that could be just more reason to make sure you follow MinnesotaReformer.com, because I'm sure you'll have something once we know a little bit more about what's happening with Mike Lindell. Maybe he'll respond and we can learn a little bit more, because, yeah, this is certainly kind of a development that came out of nowhere and is rather surprising. But as you said, probably won't necessarily put them out of business, but could be a big hindrance to their business.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of employees out there. I forget. It seems like he's trying to remember how many he said he had. I feel like it was a couple thousand, maybe. But, yeah, it's a lot of people that work out there in Shakopee, so, and in Chaska. So certainly that is, that's why I wanted to, I think it's important, like, his decision to really get so involved with politics and elections has really made, had a huge impact on that company.
We can read more about that coming up at MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. And make sure you go back in the archives and check out that article where Dina was able to spend a day with Mike Lindell, kind of learning about how he does his business and kind of being just a fly on the wall. I want to move on to one other story that you worked on, and this has to do with Republicans accusing DFLers of an unprecedented attack on religious groups. So what's happened is that religious leaders from a range of faiths are trying to convince the Minnesota State Legislature to restore an exemption in the Minnesota Human Rights Act that protects religious organizations and schools against claims of gender identity-based discrimination. The religious groups and schools want to be able to hire people who adhere to their beliefs, which in other words means they want to be able to forego hiring trans people without the threat of civil rights litigation. So current law allows a church to discriminate against a gay applicant but not a trans applicant, and Republicans thought this was an oversight in the Minnesota Human Rights Act and how that was amended during the last session. But the DFL said it was not an exemption, or it was not something, an oversight. And so I'm curious, how have lawmakers and the political parties responded to these pleas from religious organizations and schools saying that we need to have this exemption restored back in the Minnesota Human Rights Act? Because this is kind of a wide range of religious groups that came together on this issue.
Yeah, they have not gotten a very good reception. They had a hearing, in a House hearing, I think it was February 29th, the Republicans were pretty adamant that this was just an attack on religion and, the foundation of our country and the First Amendment and so on. And, very passionate about that. And the Democrats on that committee, said, actually the chair of the committee, Jamie Becker Finn, Representative Becker Finn, said it was not an oversight, that she was aware of that last session. And the Democrats on that committee were just really, really offended by the comments that the testifiers made about, LGBTQ people and their feeling that because of religious beliefs, they should have the right to decide, whether to hire them and so on. And, Minnesota's first out trans lawmaker, Representative Ray Finke, was on the committee, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but and also Representative Brian Curran was also on the committee and was very visibly upset by the testimony and said it was disgusting, infuriating, disrespectful, and a direct attack on trans and non-binary people, and felt like just really felt like it was an attack on, some of the lawmakers on the committee. So it was just really high tension and passion on both sides. And then in the Senate, they didn't get to the bill until 1 a.m. last week. And, but it was rejected in both committees, along party lines. And then yesterday, the Republicans in the House tried again to get this addressed on the floor with no success. So I suppose it's possible they would all consider this, but it doesn't look good so far for the Republicans.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next, because we have seen Republicans successfully be able to create some wedge issues at the state legislature, I think chief among them being the school resource officer bill. So I think people who may have been watching this from a political standpoint thought, well, could this bill or could this issue become the next SRO kind of thing that trips up DFLers? But at least from what I'm reading and the interactions we've been seeing over the past few days with DFLers responding to these claims from religious organizations and Republicans, they're not going to budge on this very much. So at least in terms of the future, this, at least in my eyes, this does not look likely that they are going to really be budging in trying to restore this religious exemption, correct?
No, it doesn't look like it to me. I mean, I think I read somewhere else where someone was quoted in the party saying that, you know, they'll continue talking. But I certainly, in those committees anyway, and on the floor of the House, there was a not. But yes, the Republicans, especially Representative Harry Nisca, have really been pushing, trying to get this out into the press. And Nisca put out multiple press releases and finally, they held a press conference yesterday. I was already working on a story by then, but trying to get more attention on this issue because it is something they had a good number of lawmakers at their press conference. That I do suspect we'll be hearing more about this as the elections come into focus.
And final question or topic on this has to do with, well, what could be happening next in terms of legal challenges? Because as I understand it, a number of these religious groups think they could have some standing to at least challenge this legally in the court system and possibly get this overturned or at least get that exemption reinstated. Have there been any words or rumblings on what they might be doing legally, or has this largely kind of just been chatter thus far?
The General Counsel for True North Legal, which represents religious groups, said, you know, that they're going to have a bunch of lawsuits. They kind of make it sound like they're really. I mean, it's very obvious because the United States Supreme Court had ruled in a case that the government in 2020 that the government cannot control religious schools' hiring decisions. So they don't really understand why lawmakers are just going to leave this alone and let these lawsuits play out, I guess. So I imagine, and I know Nisca had mentioned there was already one case at the State Human Rights Department, so that is involving a hiring decision involving gender identity. So I guess we shall see if anything changes, but they promise to sue.
Well, like I mentioned, this is something that Republicans are trying to turn into a wedge issue. So if you want to get a little background on this, since this could potentially become a political issue over the next few weeks and months, make sure you read Dina's article on this over at MinnesotaReformer.com titled "Republicans Accuse the DFL of Unprecedented Attack on Religious Groups." Make sure you check that out, as well as her great reporting on Mike Lindell, especially given the fact that his company is being evicted from one of their Shakopee facilities. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Dina Winter, who is with the Minnesota Reformer. Again, the website one more time, MinnesotaReformer.com. Hey, Dina, thanks so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime.
All right, let's take a break and turn things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950. Take a ride on your disco stick.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, once again, and I just, because people are talking about it on the video stream. Hello, video stream. That's right. It's radio for your eyes. People are wondering about whether or not where can we listen to this that best benefits the station? Go to am950radio.com. You can stream the show right there. By all means, you can do that there. And of course, you can watch it on the video streams. Hi, you can do that by going to our social media pages and watching them there. Lots of ways. And of course, if you miss the show, you can podcast it in all your favorite podcastable places. I'm on iTunes. I don't even know what to say about that. You type in my name on iTunes and it comes up. I'm like, oh, okay. Wow. Really? All right. But I'm there. All the interviews, too. Fugelsang will be there. We'll have the Dina Winter interview there. We are generous people. It's all for you. And once again, tune in. We had to do an update on on some of the technology stuff. We did that. It just takes them a few days to get things up and going. But if you do contact TuneIn and say, hey, can you get the TuneIn app running for AM 950 KTNF? By all means, I think they'll run with that. So there you go. Just want to make sure I address it. So thanks for listening and watching and all the things. We do appreciate you. We do love you. You guys are great. I do appreciate that greatly. We do want to mention right now, I've got a pair of tickets. I got a pair of tickets. Sexy Liberal is coming back to Minneapolis, St. Paul. This is on April 13th at the Pantages Theater. I've got a pair of tickets right now for caller number 5, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Stephanie Fugelsang, Sparks, Frangela, all coming into town, plus special guests. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Caller number 5. You'll get those tickets, so good luck to you. 952-946-6205. A few things I've got to get through, because I got to, yeah, this one, first of all, okay. A northern Minnesota man said he was jamming out a bit playing air guitar while driving last week when he fatally struck a man who just left a store in Moose Lake. Brent Kiernan, 21, of Pengilly, Minnesota, Pengilly, was charged in Carlton County District Court with criminal vehicular homicide in connection to the crash Thursday near the intersection of Industrial Park Road and John Brown Drive that killed 61-year-old Justin McNeil of Moose Lake. No relation, because McNeil is my real name. Kiernan posted bond Friday night, is due back in court on Monday. The message was left with Kiernan seeking his response to the case. To the allegations, court records do not list an attorney for him. Court records within the last 2 years show that Kiernan was caught on January 4th by Chisago County Sheriff's deputy on 35 texting on his phone while going 82 miles an hour. He pled guilty, paid a $135 fine last month. He's also been convicted in Minnesota of traveling 95 miles an hour in a 60 zone, driving an unregistered vehicle without insurance when he crashed into a FedEx truck. All right, how you doing that? Law enforcement responded shortly after 2 p.m. to a report of a crash and determined that Kiernan was driving north on Industrial Park Road, veered onto the right shoulder, and hit McNeil soon after he walked out of the nearby Dollar General store towards his home a quarter mile away. Kiernan said he was driving into his home in eastern Itasca County. After working in the Twin Cities, he said he was short on sleep after staying up the night drinking with his friends. Okay. A few hours before the crash, Kiernan said he fell asleep while driving and struck or contacted a state trooper squad vehicle while leaving the metro area. Okay, wait a second here. He hit a squad car, a trooper's vehicle, and the trooper didn't shoot him. Okay. He said the trooper measured his blood alcohol content, but it was 0.066, so below the 0.808. 0.08 is the... that's the bellwether for drunk, so he was just underneath it. He said he resumed his travels after being ticketed, stopped for a five-hour energy, and kept driving. At the time of the crash, Kiernan said he was listening to the radio when a good song began playing, prompting the defendant to play air guitar to the song, and suddenly his airbags deployed. The complaint continued. He contended that he did not know at the time he'd hit someone, but later said he was looking down and jamming out a little bit. And the next thing you know, I hit somebody. Complaint quoted him as telling law enforcement. He said his cruise control was set at 52 miles an hour in a 52 zone. Law enforcement gave Kiernan a roadside sobriety test. Once again, it showed him at underneath the 0.08, but a 0.06. But it's still vehicular homicide for sure. Yeah, I'm glad this guy's going to go to jail for a little bit. I'm glad to hear that. Patrick, who is our winner on these tickets?
Brad from Robbinsdale, congratulations. You're going to see the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour.
All right, here's the deal, folks. You did not win today. Guess what? I've got tickets. I got two more pairs of tickets to give away this week. So you'll have to keep listening Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You don't know when I'm going to give away the tickets, but I'll give them away. And you can get yourself a pair of tickets to go see Sexy Liberal. And we're going to be doing this for another few weeks, too. So make sure you keep listening to the Matt McNeil Show right here. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So I wanted to also take a few moments, if I could, to stand up for myself in regards to the story about Pine City. Now, if you missed it yesterday, one of the stories I covered was this horrible individual
in Pine City, who basically, you know, 29 years in federal prison for a Pine City man who used Snapchat to victimize hundreds of young girls. He raped at least 12, I think is the 12 of whom had been raped by this guy, who is Caleb McLaughlin, a 26-year-old Pine City man, white guy, standard, looks like, you know, your standard white guy that's in a small town sort of thing. And according to him, he used the Snapchat messaging application to exploit more than 200 girls between the ages of 11 and 16 between January 2019 and April 2023. The FBI has so far identified 26 minor victims, victims who are minors, I guess should be the better way to say that. 12 of them had been raped by McLaughlin, continues to try to identify others, and showed pronounced sexual interest in preteen teenage girls and a variety of incredibly disturbing sexual fetishes, which would terrify me to think that this is the guy that got young girls to try to do some of these things. He is an absolute creep. He's going to jail. He deserves to rot in prison. The point I need to defend, I think we all can agree, yeah, horrible guy. And, you know, he should not see the light of day. Here's the part about this which I really have a hard time with, is that and why I'm defending myself with, is because in small town America, there is this desire for villains to be within certain groups. And they want the villain to be black or from Minneapolis. And they say it just like that, too, by the way. Or a drag queen or LGBTQ population. And especially when they think about children being abused in this way, the mentality is it's got to be one of those four people, that four groups of people. They either have to be black and or from Minneapolis and or a drag queen and or LGBTQIA. And that is the small-minded nature of these fools. Now, I am a large white man. I have gone to small town Minnesota. I've been to the southern part of the state, the western part of the state, the northwestern part of the state, the Arrowhead part of the state, central part of the state. I have been there. I have been in bars and restaurants, and I have been sitting and talking to people, and they all just presume he's one of us, and they start talking. I'll give you the prime example that you'll get in small towns is they sure blame all the fentanyl and meth problems in their town on those people from Minneapolis, those people being the black people from Minneapolis. They blame them for Thief River Falls' fentanyl and meth problems. That's where it's coming from. And I'll sit and talk to them and say, wait a second, you just had a news story last week where a local couple, white, were just arrested for dealing meth or dealing fentanyl. They are where it's coming from. And it may or may not be coming through Minneapolis, but the way that this stuff is getting distributed now, most of the meth is being made locally, and most of the fentanyl could be coming from a variety of different areas. I mean, some of it getting shipped in boxes. Some of it's being delivered from Los Angeles. It could be coming from a lot of different ways. But it's being sold and distributed not by black people from Minneapolis in your small town. It's being sold and distributed by generally locals, and the vast majority of them are white. And when I brought this point up to these people, and that was a specific case. It wasn't one week in both cases. There was one guy who was a few months earlier that had been busted, and I brought him up, and then there was the one case that was the one week earlier. And I brought up, and they both said the same thing, paraphrasing, pretty close to the same thing. They said, well, that's not really the problem. That's it right there. The fact that when you bring up the drugs are coming in from a local dealer, it's a local white person who's dealing it, and their first natural instinct is to downplay that scenario and say, no, it's not the problem. It's black people from Minneapolis, which they can't even name one time when the last time they saw a black person from Minneapolis in town, but somehow, someway, they're still doing all the drug dealing. they naturally do not even want to see the crime that's going on in front of their faces, the lives that are being ruined, the families that are being destroyed. They just don't want to see it because it doesn't fit that conservative Republican mentality that they've got to be black from Minneapolis, a drag queen, or LGBTQ. And in this case in Pine City, I have zero doubt that this guy was displaying behavior that if a community was looking out for it, would have sent off a ton of red flags. These were federal charges that this guy got charged with. At no point, I guarantee it, he raped 12 girls, for God's sakes. Don't you think it would have sent off any alarm bells at the, well, here, you know, here he's got another cousin in town. I've never seen her before. Oh, well, you know, doesn't that seem a little weird that the guy's hanging out with a young girl again? Do not tell me someone in Pine City did not see this guy committing his crimes or in the act of committing his crimes and basically said, white guy locally, clearly that can't be a crime. I stand by my assessment of this. Because until you guys wake up and get away from your Fox News right-wing MAGA craziness ideas of where the problem is coming from, these problems are going to continue to exist. And right now, rural Minnesota, rural America for that matter, is in an epidemic of fentanyl and an epidemic of meth. And there is tons of these child sex offenders out there. But they're not what you want them. They're not from the nearest local major metro area. They're not black necessarily. They're not, you know, LGBTQIA. They're not drag queens. And so they are able to exist within these towns with basically no checks and balances because they got to be one of us. I am tired of it. And even when you do get these crimes found, I mean, my gosh, how many times in the last year have we had local counties or attorneys when they have like large corporations or something in town found to be guilty of crimes? Oh, I'm not going to prosecute because they're local guys. But I guarantee you, once again, if a black guy came into their community and took one penny more than they deserved out of the take a penny, leave a penny jar at the local gas station, they'd be charging the law to the fullest extent. I stand by my assessment. This guy probably was able to commit these crimes in broad daylight because they weren't looking for him. They were looking for their false narratives. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. No, it's like that Jason Aldean song. He's like, try that in a small town. People try crap like that all the time in the small town. But you're not saying that for the people of your small town. You're saying that for your perceived villains list that you try that in a small town. And meanwhile, while you're screaming like, we're tough guys taking care of our small town, your small town is following into the seventh circle of hell with drug use and all sorts of disgusting behavior. Because you're not even looking for it because, well, it's a big white guy. How could he be the problem? Exactly. Piggybacking on yesterday's coverage of what is once again a most bizarre story, I never thought that most Minnesotans would be united about anything ever again, but here we are. Thank you to Kathy Cargill. The quote that has been heard by a lot of people is Kathy Cargill in the Wall Street Journal, when basically the mayor said, hey, what are you doing buying up all these properties? What's your plan over here? She threw a temper tantrum and basically has acted as if she, you know, how dare you peasant, you know, talk, you know, ask me what I'm doing or something of that nature. I don't know. She, needless to say, her reaction was way out of line. Especially for a city just wondering what her plan was. And yeah, she didn't make it well with the rest of it. Go read the coverage. I posted the coverage out there. Billionaire Kathy Cargill made that crass comment about Duluth Mayor Roger Reinhart in the Wall Street Journal. Reinhardt expressed concern over Cargill's unknown plans for around 20 parcels of land she purchased on Park Point. And now Duluth citizens are responding to Cargill, calling their community small-minded by serving beer with a side of Cheerios and launching the Duluth Cheerios Challenge to donate the cereal to local food shelves. It's the when life gives you Cheerios, make Cheerio bars approach. Duluth's... Oh, Duluth, you're a good town, man. Duluth's a good city, man. Duluth's iconic Fitzker's Brewhouse released a new lager, the It's the new Park Point People's Pint that's served with a side of Cheerios, according to Fitzker's owner, Rod Raymond, who also operates Burrito Union. Very good, by the way. The Barrel Room and Raskeller's. Some patrons asked for a bowl so they can pour the beer right over it. No word on whether they slurped the last cereal-infused beer. Duluth labor organizer Chad McKenna started the Facebook page Duluth Cheerios Challenge, asking people to support Minnesota Food Cheers March campaign by dropping off boxes of Cheerios or other cereal money at the Duluth Labor Temple on London Road on Wednesday, March 27th through Friday, March 29th. The collection will be dispersed to several food shelves and food distribution programs in the area. General Mills, you need to get up there with a truck, man. You got to strike while the iron's hot here. We want to take what was said and turn it into a positive, McKenna said, noting that the campaign isn't intended to pass judgment on Cargill. Of course it's not. Wink. Of course no one is passing judgment on Cargill. Wink, wink. Nicely done, Duluth. Can I say one quick thing about Cheerios, which is interesting? I have family on the East Coast that come out here, and one of the first things they do is, I need to get your Cheerios. And you're like, what? She says, our Cheerios here are 1,000 times better than the Cheerios they get on the East Coast. And so apparently Cheerios is like Guinness. The further away you get from Dublin, the worse the Guinness tastes. And apparently that's the same thing for Minnesota and Cheerios. Now, once again, I do not advise bathroom Cheerio things. But still, enjoy however you so choose. And this is not going to go away anytime quickly. Native Roots Radio is up next. Have a good one. We are back on a Wednesday. Till then, see ya.